This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Rachel Mealy. This Wednesday, calls for a better approach to mental health, with new figures showing one in three Australian women struggle with anxiety. And a disastrous World Cup, no coach, and an embattled chief executive. What's wrong with Australian rugby?
Overall, I think there's been way too much attention and certainly too much resources put into purely the Wallabies, the pointy end of the pyramid, at the expense of the base.
First today, the Australian Defence Force has confirmed a handful of its buildings contain flammable cladding, but details about other Commonwealth-owned buildings with the potentially deadly material are being kept secret. An audit was launched following London's Grenfell Tower inferno in 2017, which killed more than 70 people. So far in Australia, 11 Commonwealth-owned buildings have been identified as having flammable cladding. Political reporter Stephanie Boris has more.
Fire Brigade.
Yeah, hello. Hi. In the fire, flat 16 Grenfell Tower.
72 people died after a fire broke out in the Grenfell Tower in 2017.
Okay. Quick.
They're on the way already. Yes, I know it's...
Flammable cladding was what fuelled the blaze that engulfed the 24-storey apartment block in London. The tragedy led to the federal and state governments in Australia examining which buildings here have the dangerous material. 2 years on, and the Australian government's cladding audit of Commonwealth-owned buildings is still going.
I'm surprised and alarmed.
Brendan O'Connor is the Shadow Industry Minister.
I think what is expected of the Commonwealth and the federal government is to provide an all-of-government statement about the progress of the audit and the progress of the rectification where required.
The Department of Industry says the cladding audit is ongoing, and so far 11 Commonwealth-owned buildings have been identified as having flammable cladding. No details have been provided about how safety improvements are progressing and how much longer the audit will take. And Industry Minister Karen Andrews is refusing to say where the 11 buildings are.
There has been concerns that public disclosure of specific buildings is likely to lead to a risk of arson. So what we have to do is balance the information that's publicly available.
But in Senate estimates this morning, Defence confirmed it has 5 buildings with flammable cladding, and it had no trouble detailing on the public record where they are. Steve Krishkovyak leads Defence's Estate and Infrastructure Group.
HMAS Penguin in Sydney. Second building is at HMAS Cairns. Third building is at RAAF Townsville. Fourth building is at Fisherman's Bend Laboratories. And the fifth building is at RAAF Edinburgh.
Defence's Chris Bira told Senate estimates that work is underway to make the buildings safe.
Corrective actions for 3 of the non-compliant Defence-owned buildings consist of installation of fireproof awnings over fire exits to ensure occupants evacuating the buildings are protected from any falling or dripping material from above, from the non-compliant material.
Fireproof awnings.
Awnings, yes. Yep. Corrective action for the 2 remaining Defence-owned buildings include removal of non-compliant material and replacing with a compliant cladding, with all remediation expected to be completed by the end of 2019.
Defence officials confirm staff working in these buildings have been told about the cladding, but under questioning from Labor Senator Penny Wong, they couldn't say when that happened.
In respect of the 5 buildings for which risk has been identified, have personnel working inside those buildings been advised of that fact?
My understanding, Senator, is that they have. They are practising fire escape more regularly than would normally be the case.
When were they advised?
I'd have to take that on notice.
There are even less details when it comes to what other buildings contain flammable cladding. The Department of Industry has not confirmed if the 5 defence buildings are among the 11 identified or if they're on top of that figure. As to whether all staff working in the 11 buildings have been notified about the risk, Industry Minister Karen Andrews was asked that question by RN Breakfast's Hamish McDonald.
The processes for rectification work are already underway, so there would be a level of visibility. so that, yes, there would be an understanding by at least some of the building occupants that that remediation work is underway. Now, clearly,
that's a pretty oblique way of informing people that their building that they're working in is not safe, isn't it? I mean, are you being upfront with these people and saying, look, you work in a building that is not safe?
I'm being as upfront as I can at this point in time. What we don't want to do is alarm people unnecessarily.
Labor's Brendan O'Connor says her response raises questions about who knows what and is demanding further details.
It's in the public interest that people know, for public safety reasons, whether there are buildings that are potentially dangerous.
Shadow Industry Minister Brendan O'Connor ending that report by Stephanie Boris. Results out today show 1 in 3 Australian women are struggling with anxiety and they're not getting the help they need. The annual report by Jean Hales for Women's Health also shows anxiety is the most sought-after health topic among 18 to 35-year-old women. The Health Minister Greg Hunt says Australia is making progress with women's health, but more needs to be done. And as Mary Lloyd reports, experts say women's mental health should be a national priority.
And heels. And double.
At an exercise class for mothers, Sarah Gummison laughs along with other mums as they do their best to stay active. It helps ease her struggle with anxiety.
For me, the physical reaction happens very much inside. I can't quite breathe properly and I kind of just can't get comfortable.
Doubting her ability to care for her children often sets it off.
That feeling of pure incompetence.
Worry is normal in most people, but in a growing number of women, that feeling of fear becomes so bad it stops them from functioning. A survey released today by Jean Hales for Women's Health showed more than 1 in 3 Australian women struggle with anxiety.
The challenges are real.
Launching the report today at Parliament House, Health Minister Greg Hunt says more needs to be done to improve women's health.
For young women, the overwhelming message is they want and need more help on mental health and in particular anxiety.
Professor Jayashree Kulkarni says there's not a strong enough focus on what causes women to experience poor mental health and how best to treat it.
We need to actually be able to understand that women's mental health is a different kind of set of symptoms and consequences compared to men's mental health.
She wants more women to have access to female-focused health centres, better research into how hormones affect mental conditions, and greater appreciation of the multiple pressures on women today.
As a society, we cannot afford to lose women to mental illness.
Nicole Hyatt of the Centre for Perinatal Excellence says the treatment many women receive is far from adequate.
We hear where women have gone to their GP, for example, or a health professional, and they've said, well, you just need to get some rest.
Research from her centre shows more than 70% of women don't seek help until they reach crisis point. She says this can be a result of unrealistic expectations of women and by women.
That fear of failure or feeling like they've failed themselves as a person and as a mother is preventing people from putting their hand up or wanting to disclose and get help early.
Sarah Gummison is among the women who sought help. Now that she has a good psychologist, she no longer blames herself for the tough days.
You have to realise for yourself that it's okay to not be okay. It is okay to ask for help. It is okay to accept help. And I think as soon as you open yourself up to allowing yourself to do those things, then it just gets that little bit easier.
That's mother of two, Sarah Gummison, ending that report by Mary Lloyd. One of Australia's most prominent anti-domestic violence campaigners has joined forces with a national women's legal group to launch an alternative to the federal government's family law inquiry. The Prime Minister announced the joint parliamentary inquiry into Australia's family law system last month, the fourth of its kind in the past 3 years. There's been heavy criticism of that inquiry from campaigners, including Rosie Batty, who say another investigation is stalling reforms that desperately need to be implemented now. Victoria Pengilly reports.
4 years ago, Michelle Dorindel's then partner took their daughter Ava on a court-approved access visit and didn't return. They were found dead under a tree 17 days later, a murder-suicide. Now she wants the system changed to prevent tragedies like her own.
They really need to prioritise the safety of children in these matters. There isn't the recognition and understanding of DV and of abusive dynamics in the system.
Central to Michelle Dorindel's argument is that the family court needs to focus on identifying domestic violence cases. Echoing her call is prominent advocate Rosie Batty. Both campaigners have joined forces with the Women's Legal Services Australia to launch a new plan they say will prioritise the safety of children by testing evidence more quickly and thoroughly.
First and foremost, this should be about the safety of children. Because you're a parent, it doesn't give you any entitlement if you don't conduct yourself in a way that is non-violent. Regardless of anyone's gender, it should be about the children. And it seems to me that that has never been first and foremost.
And again, Rosie Batty is questioning the federal government's motivation for yet another family law inquiry.
Why would we need another inquiry when we've already had two and we've not acted on any of those recommendations? I think the bias has already been stated publicly. And so I think with that premise, I feel makes it very concerning for people who are experiencing family violence to come forward.
A parliamentary investigation into the family law system was controversially announced by the Prime Minister last month. Yesterday, Minister for Women Maurice Payne defended the decision, telling Senate estimates Parliament is entitled to inquire into the family law system. One Nation's Pauline Hanson is also tipped to co-chair the inquiry. Helen Matthews is from the Women's Legal Service Australia.
You know, I think it's a big ask to say to women, please come and expose your story, your past, for the sake of the future, knowing that lead person on that inquiry is driven by the notion that men are being disadvantaged in the family law system, which is simply not the case. Our view is that there need to be some really serious safeguards put in place.
The organisation, which represents more than a dozen women's legal services around the country, has urged the family law courts to strengthen their response to family violence and provide effective legal help for disadvantaged clients. Helen Matthews says her proposals for reform can be implemented now, instead of a lengthy inquiry that could re-traumatise women who are called to give evidence again.
The proposals that we're putting in our five-step plan now, which address more immediate and doable issues around family violence in the family law system, actually can be implemented without waiting for the outcome from the inquiry.
Helen Matthews from Women's Legal Services Australia, Victoria Pengilly reporting. This is The World Today. Well, it's been a day of high drama in the British Parliament as the tussle over Brexit rolls on. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson had both a victory and a defeat, as if to underline the very nature of the Brexit saga. The win came when the House of Commons approved the Brexit deal he nutted out with the European Union last week, but it was a short-lived victory. Parliament then voted down his bid to have the legislation passed within 3 days. Dr. Geoff Lelliott is from the School of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Queensland. I spoke to him a short time ago and began by asking, what now?
Well, that's a bit unclear. First of all, you know, Parliament was possibly giving Boris Johnson a nice reminder that, sure, he may have got victory on one vote, but Parliament still sees itself and can see itself as being in control of some of these events. It's unclear what it means from here, because initially Johnson said that he would withdraw the bill and seek a general election. Now he said he's paused the bill to wait and see what the European Union says in terms of a further extension. And it's just all very unclear whether they're going to be able to negotiate a timetable for getting the bill through Parliament, you know, with more scrutiny than the 3 days that was initially being offered, whether the bill will be withdrawn, whether they'll get a general election, and then, you know, who knows what happens after that, because a lot will depend on the outcome of the election as well.
You get the impression that the European Union is sort of taking a collective eye roll on every development out of Britain. What's the appetite in Brussels to allow a further extension?
Yeah, I think that collective eye roll isn't just from the European Union. I think much of the world looks on and gives a collective eye roll at some of this stuff. The sense coming out of the European Union is that they will get an extension probably through to the 31st of January. There is some hesitance. The general sentiment is that, yes, it will go ahead. There is some hesitancy from the French, but I don't think the French will break a united position from the EU. There is, of course, the fact that all EU member states have to agree to the extension. So whilst the French, I don't think, will be the ones to say no if the feeling amongst, you know, the major players is yes, there's the possibility that any country may veto the extension. The other thing to think about as well is the fact that the European Union is also debating whether to offer what's been dubbed a flextension, that idea that rather than saying let's extend until the 31st of January, full stop, that instead they say, well, extend until the 31st of January, but if the UK finally passes the legislation, then the UK can leave earlier.
So Boris Johnson said before Parliament that if the deadlock continues into next year, he might pull the Brexit bill altogether and go to a general election. Do you think that that was just a threat at that stage, or is he inclined to do that?
Oh, look, I think he does genuinely want a general election. I think especially if he can get a deal either through the Parliament or looking likely to get through the Parliament, I think he would... He would love a general election. You know, he has a charisma that few politicians have. He would be in a good position to secure a comfortable majority. The consensus is that Labour would be roundly hammered. If he's got the chance of a deal going through Parliament or has got a deal through Parliament, he would see off the Brexit Party as well. I think he would be in a very good position for an election. Of course, two caveats on that. One is that people said the Labour Party would be hammered in 2017, and that, including myself, I said it too, and they weren't. And the other thing, of course, is that he doesn't get to choose the date of an election, so he doesn't have total control over the process.
That's University of Queensland political science expert Dr. Geoff Lelliott. The fallout continues after the Wallabies' disastrous quarter-final exit from the Rugby World Cup in Japan. After the comprehensive defeat by England, coach Michael Checker revealed he had a toxic relationship with the management of Rugby Australia. He said he'll step down as coach, but the question is, how can the Wallabies rebuild their reputation and position in world rugby? Julia Holman reports.
When Wallabies coach Michael Checker faced the media following the team's thrashing by England over the weekend, he was asked if he would step down. He didn't take it well.
It's a cruel, cruel world nowadays when you're asking those questions 2 minutes after the World Cup. We've been knocked out of the World Cup. Just chill.
But hours later, he announced he'll quit at the end of the year and dropped the bombshell that he had no working relationship with his boss, the CEO of Rugby Australia, Raylene Castle.
I've pretty much got no relationship with the CEO and not much with the chairman.
Today on RN Breakfast, Raylene Castle tried to duck questions on just how toxic management's relationship was with the Wallabies coach.
You know, at the end of the day, Michael's decided not to seek reappointment. For us, the focus is about making sure that we work through a process to appoint the best coach that we can find.
She says the breakdown occurred when new staff were brought in to try to lift the team's performance.
We had to make some changes. At the end of last year, we had a 50% win record. That was not acceptable from the board's point of view.
Rugby Australia says it will conduct a review into the team's failure at the World Cup. For former Wallabies captain Andrew Slack, the poor performance wasn't a surprise.
Well, I think the coach was poor and the selecting was poor. And what Rugby Australia did, and they've made plenty of blues, I believe, but in terms of what they did at the end of last year to get a selection panel and get a rugby framework around Checker, the thing that he's now complaining about was what needed to be done a lot earlier. He was given far too much leniency and independence and almost to the dictatorial stage ever since he's been coach. And he hasn't been successful. And yet he's just kept doing it his way, his way, his way. And finally, at the end of last year, Rugby Australia woke up and said, gee, this isn't getting us very far. They did something too little, too late.
Some, including broadcaster and former Wallabies coach Alan Jones, are calling for Raylene Castle to resign. Andrew Slack doesn't want that to happen, but says there does need to be changes at the top level of Australian rugby.
The board has also overseen paying a lot of money and giving long contracts to various people, Michael Hooper and David Pocock, for example, which I think could be questioned. You know, we've got to start ensuring the players realise that they're not, in a sense, the people who are going to run the show. So there's a whole, I hate the word actually, but there is a bit of a cultural change that needs to happen within the team and within the body itself.
Peter Fitzsimons is a Sydney Morning Herald journalist and a former representative rugby player. He describes the Wallabies' performance at the World Cup as deeply disappointing.
It's not all Michael Checker's fault. It's not all the board's fault. The CEO, Chair's not their fault. I mean, all put together, it just didn't work.
He says it's not surprising relations between Checker and Rugby Australia broke down.
Michael Checker is a rambunctious character. He's prickly. He bristles. He is that kind of a guy. If I was the CEO, if you were the CEO, it wouldn't surprise me if either of us had a tempestuous relationship with Michael Checker.
And his advice to Rugby Australia is to try to poach England's coach, Australian Eddie Jones. And while he doesn't believe there should be a clean out of rugby's administration, he does think there needs to be more of a focus on the grassroots.
There's a camp which says blow the whole thing up. I'm not in that camp. We've lost at the top level, but it may be time also to say there are far more KPIs, if I can use that corporate term, for the health of Australian rugby than how the Wallabies do. Overall, I think there's been way too much attention and certainly too much resources put into purely the Wallabies, the pointy end of the pyramid, at the expense of the base.
That's writer Peter Fitzsimons ending that report from Julia Holman. This week, the ABC's Australia Talks project has been turning its attention to the question of Australian identity, perhaps more important than ever in a nation of migrants that's undergoing a population explosion. In places like Truganina in Melbourne's Outer West, around half the population was born overseas, many from South Asian countries like India and Bangladesh. Parents who migrated as adults can have a very different sense of feeling Australian to their children who were born here. And as Ben Knight reports, the need to bridge those cultural gaps is a more serious concern than most Australian parents could ever imagine.
Straight on the wicket, no mercy for anybody.
Miraj is the captain of the Truganina under 14 girls, and they're about to play their first home game of the season.
Don't try hit it on leg side, try throwing onto offside.
These girls are the daughters of Indian Muslim migrants, and they play with their headscarves under their helmets. Tonight, their opponents are the European and Asian girls from Hoppers Crossing, all enjoying Australia's national sport.
Make it two. Run back.
As parents cheer on from the sidelines in the twilight, it's as Australian a scene as you could imagine. But it wasn't easy making this happen.
People told us, no, my girl is not for this.
Jamal Muhammad is Miraj's dad. He got this team going 2 years ago, but he got resistance from other parents in the community. His message to them was clear.
You took an oath, be an Australian in real way.
I play it at school. I used to watch cricket on TV since I was small.
This year, Zenith, 11 years old, is playing her first season with this team. And she has a clear idea of what it means to be Australian.
But I think everyone should have their opportunities. Everyone should be free to do what they want.
But her mum was not keen at first. It was her dad, Ismail, who talked his wife round.
She was a bit concerned, saying, oh, what are our family back home going to think that our daughter is going to play cricket? And I'm like, well, times have changed now.
In more ways than one. Jamal Muhammad says in this community there's genuine concern that idle kids are vulnerable to radicalisation.
If we are not engaging the kids, there is a possibility of them getting into extremism. The reason is social media access. You can't control social media.
And it is the children of Muslim migrants who are targeted by extremist groups. And their online propaganda focuses on that sense of identity, of kids who might be caught between two cultures and questioning where they belong. Perhaps how Australian they feel. The ABC's Australia Talks survey has been posing that question. And overall, it found people scored themselves 8 out of 10 for feeling Australian. But perhaps not surprisingly, non-white respondents scored themselves lower, and those who migrated within the last 10 years, lower still. People like Zena's father, Ismail.
I still feel there is a lot of cultural difference for me. At times I do feel a bit hard to get into the system. But for my kids, when I look at them, I'm like, oh, these guys are already Aussies.
Truganina got the win against Hoppers Crossing. And after the teams shook hands came what's probably the most important part, when the two teams and their parents head into the club room for an Indian feast.
Thanks for coming. And see you again.
But even more important, is what happens in the years to come.
We as parents can create a platform for the girls. They can come express themselves. Sky's the limit. Love what you do and just live your life.
Cricket parent Ismail Mohammed. And that's all from the World Today team for this Wednesday. I'm Rachel Mealy. Have a lovely afternoon.
Nearly 3 years in, and despite what he says,
there was no collusion,
the Russia story isn't going away. But for Vladimir Putin, the US election was only part of his plan.
A Malaysian Airlines plane has crashed while flying over the eastern region of Ukraine.
Criminal investigation for donations made during the Brexit referendum.
Russia, if you're listening, has returned for a third season, looking at Putin's grand chess match with the West. Subscribe now on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.